Welcome to Endo Battery, where I share about my endometriosis and adenomyosis story and continue learning along the way. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice or diagnosis, but a place to equip you with information and a sense of community, ensuring you never have to face this journey alone. Join me as I navigate the ups and downs and share stories of strength, resilience, and hope while navigating the world of endometriosis and adenomyosis from personal experience to expert insights. I'm your host, Alana, and this is Endo Battery, charging our lives when endometriosis drains us. Welcome back to Endo Battery. Grab your cup of coffee or your cup of tea and join my guest tonight, Dr. Jen Yagi, at the table. Dr. Jen is a board-certified OBGYN that practiced as a general OBGYN for nearly 10 years, but recently started her fellowship for advanced endometriosis and pelvic surgery with Dr. Cindy Mossberger at Pacific Endometriosis and Pelvic Surgery in Gig Harbor, Washington. Thank you, Jen, so much for joining me today. I'm excited to have you on. Thanks for taking the time to do that.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Yes. I'm excited to have you join me today for a couple different reasons. One of the reasons is that you have a unique perspective to give to those of us within the endometriosis community. But also, I just think that you have a great way of giving us insight to something that maybe we have become blind to as far as when it comes to doctors wanting to have the best for their patients, but not equipped properly to do so and doing something about that. And I think I'm excited to hear more about your story. And so without further ado, if you wouldn't mind sharing just a little bit of who you are and what your background is.
Of course. And yeah, thank you again for having me. I was, you know, surprised to hear that you would want to have a fellow who's early in training in endometriosis on your podcast. But I guess there's one thing that I can offer. I guess my story to getting where I am is probably unique, though I realize everyone's story in one way or another is unique in terms of how they get to where they are. See, for a long time, I knew I wanted to be a physician. I think during med school itself, I for a while was kind of struggling with what my niche or my, you know, specialty would be. I think I've always been drawn to anatomy and sort of the more concrete, you know, where you have a visual problem in front of you and, you know, a concrete solution. So I think I was always more drawn to the surgical specialties. And yet on some of my surgery rotations, you know, I did a rotation in ENT and plastic surgery. While I loved the hands-on time in the OR, I felt like maybe in terms of the personalities, I hadn't quite found my people, you know, in the sense that I also really liked the continuity with patients. And I really enjoyed talking to patients about their stories. And I know that's a generalization. I'm not saying that, that general surgeons or orthopedists don't, you know, enjoy that too. But I think, you know, there are different personalities in the stereotypes of the medical world. And so when I did my OBGYN rotation, I really did enjoy, you know, just the connection that the physicians had and really getting to take care of patients sort of through all ages and, you know, seeing teenagers for their painful periods and then seeing women during their pregnancies and really all the way through menopause and prolapse. Like, I really did like the breadth of it and just really the continuity that a lot of the OBGYNs had with their patients. So I think that's ultimately what brought me to OBGYN. But I was always from the beginning thinking that I wanted to focus more on the GYN side. I loved my GYN oncology rotations as a medical student and really initially actually thought I would do OBGYN residency to then go on to oncology. I just felt like they were amazing surgeons. And again, the hands-on part, I really loved the OR. And then I think, you know, at the time when I was in residency too, my dad was sick with cancer. And I think there was this part of the breadth of general OBGYN that I liked. And I suddenly found myself not wanting perhaps every patient, you know, to be a cancer patient. So yeah, found myself deciding that I was going to be doing general OBGYN, at least for a bit, with the idea in the back of my head that I would still go on to do a fellowship. You know, I then thought maybe MIGS or Urogyn. I was always drawn to working in a more underserved, low-resource area during med school and residency. Did rotations abroad in Guatemala and in Uganda, South Africa. And I think if it hadn't been for the fact that my dad was sick at the time, I probably would have ventured off to another country after residency. But someone told me, no, if you want to do, you know, work in a low resource setting, kind of without leaving the country, you should really look at IHS, the Indian Health Service. Yeah. And just by chance, there were two MIGs, which is minimally invasive GYN surgeons, who were going out to one of the hospitals in New Mexico on the Navajo reservation called Shiprock. So I joined them for a week of surgeries. They were doing kind of the more complex surgeries that the GYNs there had kind of saved for that week that they were visiting. You know, the goal of the week, I think, was really to both do the surgeries that maybe otherwise would have had to be referred out, right, and also, you know, to bring more knowledge to the GYNs that were practicing there. And just through a kind of series of small world connections, met another physician who was at another neighboring Navajo area hospital in Gallup. And a few months later, found myself taking a job at that hospital called Gallup Indian Medical Center, where I then practiced for the next, you know, I thought it would be a couple years until I went back to fellowship, but two became six, became, gosh, almost 10. Shortly after getting there, or about 2.5 years after getting there, we went from being a group of six GYNs to three. There were several GYNs who just moved on for other reasons. You know, one retired, one went on to an administrative role, someone had a baby and moved closer to family. But we were suddenly in a lurch having three docs instead of six. And so it just did not feel like the time to move on. And I got thrown into a leadership role as well. I ended up taking on the OB chief role just a couple of years after residency, which in hindsight, you know, was one of those things you look back on. And, you know, I certainly learned a lot, but I'm not sure I would have chosen that same route. And then a couple of years later, had my first baby, and that seemed also not the time to venture back to fellowship. And then, you know, that thing called COVID turned the world upside down. So having to kind of lead the department through that, the Navajo Nation got really hardly hit by COVID, which, you know, would be a whole other podcast on its own. But it took a couple of years to really feel like we were on our feet. And, you know, it was at that point that I was like, okay, if I really want to go back to further my surgical training, like this would be, I think, the time to do it. Or otherwise, you know, I think maybe I will continue down this route of general OBGYN. And it was through another sort of series of small world connections. I was at an AAGL conference in December 2022, when one of my former residency friends introduced me to Dr. Mossbrucker, who runs Pacific Endometriosis and Pelvic Surgery, and said that she had prior fellows, you know, that she trained in endometriosis surgery. Started talking with her and ended up coming out for a week to see her in practice, both in clinic with patients and in the OR. And yeah, just really got drawn into this, what we call, world of endometriosis. I was just so struck, you know, by the stories that I heard when she was in clinic. You know, she really took the time with the patients that often, you know, in other settings, you don't see possible, you know, in a 15-minute appointment. And just hearing about patients who had seen doctor after doctor and either not been diagnosed or had surgeries, but they were incomplete surgeries and so were having, you know, continued pain. So yeah, I was really drawn in on the clinic days. And then of course the OR days was almost feeling like, wow, I'm like back on my GYN oncology rotations, you know, in terms of the complexity of these surgeries and just how elegantly she does them, except these aren't cancer surgeries. These are benign surgeries. And, you know, in many ways, it is similar, right? With cancer, you're trying to get it all out. And with endo as well, it just somehow, you know, I feel like it's a whole other discussion too, but cancer, you know, in terms of the training programs is just a much more established world than endometriosis training. So to make a long story short, I went home and told my partner, now my husband, that I felt like this is what I needed to do next. And within a few months, we moved up from sunny New Mexico to rainy Washington. And I'm now 6 months into my fellowship at Pacific Endometriosis and Pelvic Surgery with Dr. Mossbrucker. And yeah, learning a lot.
Journey. And do you ever sit back and look back at where you started out as as an OBGYN and the stories that you would hear from patients, and knowing now what you know, looking back and saying, I wonder if that patient had endo. I wish I would have been able to refer this patient out or help this patient more. What has that looked like from that transition?
I think when you go through OBGYN residency, I think we are well trained to diagnose those classic cases of endometriosis, but it's the, you know, the ones who maybe don't follow the classic story that I look back and wonder about, you know, patients mm-hmm. where I missed that diagnosis. I was thinking about it as an example, like, I think it was just a couple of weeks ago, I was seeing a patient for a new consultation. And I remember when I was presenting it to Dr. Mosbrucker, I said, you know, on first glance, like, this didn't seem like a classic story to me, but, you know, she's been on OCPs this whole time. So, you know, I think it was probably suppressed. She was a patient who was having more bowel symptoms and more bladder symptoms. And the pain really hadn't become an issue until she stopped birth control. And, you know, as I was presenting, I was like, huh, this is the kind of patient that, yeah, I think a couple years ago, I would have more quickly jumped to like, oh, this is probably mm-hmm. GI, or, you know, she should be seen for a workup for IBS or for interstitial cystitis, and not kind of have put the, you know, the more subtle mm-hmm. things together. Yeah, I do. And I think about, you know, the patients that I had where I did ablation of endometriosis, or honestly, even the ones, you know, I can think of one case where I was planning to do a laparoscopic hysterectomy for fibroids and adenomyosis, and got in, and it was, you know, a much more complex case of stage 4 endometriosis. Mm. And in that case, you know, I recognized that that was above my surgical skill set, and we called it a diagnostic laparoscopy. Mm-hmm. You know, she just ended up with like one or two small incisions, and then referred her on to the closest tertiary care center for what I thought would be, you know, a minimally invasive procedure. She ended up having an open hysterectomy. Mm. I think had her ovary taken out as well. I think oncology ended up doing the case. When I think back, I was like, I mean, even in all of New Mexico, I don't think there are many true excision specialists. Maybe now I would know, like, you know, mm-hmm. there may have been somewhere in Arizona or, you know, somewhere where she could have had a truly minimally invasive procedure.
Yeah.
But, you know, do the best that you can with the knowledge that you have at the time. And, you know, I think at least with that case, you know, I, as a physician, you learn first, do no harm. You know, I didn't mm-hmm. go into a surgery that I thought was above my skill set. It's sad to think that even with referring her on, you know, she may not have had the most optimal surgery.
Yeah. And that brings us to the other point too, of what you're learning in med school and even in your continuing education as far as endometriosis is concerned, because you probably hadn't heard much about endometriosis beyond just what text was given to you or what little pieces you've been given in medical school. Was that the case for you?
I mean, I've spent a lot of time thinking about what exactly did I learn during med school and residency. Yeah, I mean, certainly in medical school, I mean, there are so many areas, you know, that are covered that nothing really gets more than like a half day or a day other than probably the heart and the lungs. I remember there being a lot of emphasis, on hormonal treatment of endometriosis. So, you know, it's maybe not surprising that the med school teaching on endometriosis wasn't that thorough. I think during residency, I honestly think, I mean, I started residency in 2009, finished in 2013. I think even then, like, excision was really just starting mm-hmm. to be kind of more commonly done. You know, what I recall of endometriosis cases was ablation of, like, mm-hmm. you know, the stage 1 and 2 cases. And then I remember being involved with the more complex, like, stage 3 or 4 cases. But usually it was that the oncologists were mm-hmm. getting called in because it was a frozen pelvis. Or it was, you know, some of the MIG surgeons were doing, mm-hmm. you know, the more complex dissections where bowel was scarred to the bladder. And, you know, I remember long surgeries, but I don't really remember being taught about excision as like a concept. I think, you know, we were taught you should take a biopsy for confirmation, but the idea of really trying to remove all visible endometriosis, I feel like, it's not something that I recall being taught as a resident.
Yeah.
The focus is more on the hormonal treatment, the teaching that it should get resolve once you go through menopause. And, you know, again, the idea that the ovaries are removed, you know, that there's no longer the driver of endometriosis.
Yeah. Which I think too, I mean, I think to put this in perspective for everyone that's listening who has gone through the doctors, like myself, I had a great doctor, but again, she had that same training to do the ablation. She had the same education as taking the ovaries out and doing hormonal suppressions and things like that. But I don't think she came at it from a malicious standpoint or she had to be right standpoint. It was, she really truly thought she was doing the best she absolutely could for me. And she felt like she was adequate in her knowledge of endometriosis and her skill set in endometriosis surgeries. So even though, and I think that we talk a lot about the medical trauma that we've faced, and certainly this is not to bunch every doctor into that category, but by and large, I would say most OBGYNs are doing their absolute best with what they've been given. And I think it's just as a testament to you going in an area that really healthcare is hard to come by and it maybe isn't always the best in general because it's not going to be your high paying market, you know. It's a different area. It's a different way of living. And so I think you did something that was so impactful and you stuck in there. So I know just from talking to you that you truly care about your patients. So you would never want to lead them astray or hurt them or, you know, and I want to emphasize that for those who have been through that medical trauma too. Yes, not every doctor's the same, but most of them want to do the best for you.
And I think, you know, some of the limitations too are the system. When I think that, you know, the average appointment length is 15 minutes, that doesn't really give the time to sometimes dig into, you know, all of the symptoms or even, you know, do very thorough assessment. Like that's one of the luxuries that I do have now. We have 45 minutes to an hour with every new patient and you can dig into things a little more deeply. And yeah, it's interesting because I feel like I really was seeking out more surgical training because I think that's a more obvious, you know, you more clearly see tools in your toolbox are lacking. Like I knew stage 3 endometriosis cases are not something that I can do after finishing a general OBGYN residency. But I think, you know, we leave residency feeling like we have the medical, you know, knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part that in a way has almost been more surprising with doing this fellowship, just that I may not been asking the right questions or just, again, like you mentioned, thinking about those patients where I may have missed the diagnosis, even though I thought I was being thorough. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things that you have really learned doing this fellowship that maybe were shocking, but more like, wow, this is blowing my mind on this information, you know, because I certainly have learned a lot and I'm obviously not in a fellowship. I'm just, you know, a host for a podcast, but I've learned so much. I can only assume that you have had that same experience of like, wow, this, I had no idea. What are some of those things that have been just shocking to you or enlightening?
I mean, one thing, you know, that I feel like, again, wasn't on my radar as much. And you spend a lot of time thinking back to is like, did I just not know that? Or was that just general gap in knowledge? But like, for instance, adenomyosis, where we were kind of taught as something that is more an issue of women who've had multiple pregnancies and can only be diagnosed at time of hysterectomy. But, you know, I'm seeing a fair number of patients that have not had any children and are, you know, in their early 20s, even where their symptoms are classic for adenomyosis. And then the ultrasound suggests adenomyosis. And when you look in at time of surgery, see, again, you know, the gold standard really still is to only make that diagnosis at time of hysterectomy. But yeah, I've been learning there's a lot of other ways that you can almost make that diagnosis. Ultrasound is another thing where, you know, I was doing quite a bit of ultrasound as a general OBGYN, but usually in the context of, you know, an early pregnancy, ruling out abnormalities there, and not really thinking about ultrasound as something that can give you hints that there may be endometriosis, you know. So we usually, for ultrasounds that I wasn't doing for, you know, like someone walking in with abnormal bleeding and a positive pregnancy test, more often, if we were wanting to look at the uterus or the ovaries, we would order the ultrasound. It would get done in radiology. So, you know, we order it, then the tech takes the images, and then it gets sent to the radiologist who looks at those static images. And then a couple of days later, you get the report back. And, you know, often it would say, you know, just that the uterus was a normal size. There were, there was maybe a physiologic cyst on the ovary, or, you know, essentially that it was unremarkable. Now, you know, with every consult that I'm doing with Dr. Mossbrucker, we do an ultrasound while the patient's there. And there's really just so much more that you can see with the ultrasound if you kind of use it as a tool in real time. You know, you can see if the ovaries are tethered or stuck to the sidewall, if the ovaries are stuck to the uterus, if there's movement between the cervix and the rectum, and, you know, and more subtle signs of adenomyosis you can see as well. And again, that's something that, you know, I was been doing ultrasound for years, but never really thought of it as a way to look for some of the markers of endometriosis. You know, if everything is stuck together, or if patients have pain when you're pushing on the uterus sacral ligaments, you know, it really is almost an extension of the exam that is really pretty, you know, simple and can just really help or make you more suspicious that the underlying issue could be endometriosis, as opposed to just saying, oh, that one, you know, came back unremarkable. And, you know, we don't know why you're having this pain.
And I think that's true. I mean, that's more and more a conversation that, we've been having within the endometriosis community is imaging, right? Because, you know, we've been taught for many years the only way that you can truly identify endometriosis is through a laparoscopic surgery. And to 100% diagnose, yes, that's still the case. However, imaging is doing a great job now with giving doctors a roadmap. But a lot of times, if you just order the images and let someone else read them, you're not seeing the roadmap. You're letting someone else draw it out for you. And I think that that has been a conversation that's really starting to take hold within the last couple years, probably. But I think maybe that is a good differentiating factor between a specialist and, kind of, for lack of a better word, but a generalist. Because even though OBGYNs are still specialties within what they're doing, they're still not a specialist in GYN. And so I think that is another thing to consider when people are looking to find treatment for this.
So I think having that ultrasound in connection with the, you know, a thorough history and exam. Yeah, I've also, in terms of the things you're asking about, things I've learned or been surprised about, you know, I don't feel like I learned very much about like pelvic floor dysfunction and, you know, incorporating that into every exam I do. And just the number of patients that are not only dealing with endometriosis, but pelvic floor spasm, or who have symptoms of interstitial cystitis, like they're so often all tied together.
Which is, I know
it's not any news to you, but yeah.
But it would be, I mean, I wouldn't have known that in my journey, you know, and I kind of correlate your journey to a lot of us who have gone through this, because we've all started really in the same place, right? You on the doctor's side, us on the patient side, but we're walking through it and learning more and becoming better advocates for those with endometriosis because of our lived experiences, because of what drives us, right? So I think the value in us doing this together and what you're learning, I'm right there with you for a lot of it. So it's kind of fun. I'm really, that's why I wanted to talk to you, because I was like, wow, this really feels like you're walking with me on this stuff too and learning with me.
Yeah, just has, I'd say like the part, that the end of the day leaves me so sad on many days is just how many doctors patients have already seen and, you know, how long it's been until they get that, you know, appointment where they feel like someone is kind of putting it all together, or, you know, they, then they have the surgery, which then the large majority of the time kind of shows what we were suspecting. And I can't tell you how many times there are patients in tears at their consults, just feeling like they're finally validated. And
as a patient who has felt that way, again, I don't blame my doctor for not knowing what she didn't know. It's just not well known outside of the specialty, really. But I'm excited to see where you're going with this. So you are doing a fellowship now. Can you explain what a fellowship is? Because I think that a lot of us hear about excision specialists and they hear about these specialists, but there's a step to getting to that point of being a specialist, and that's the fellowship. Can you explain what the fellowship is and what the different kind of fellowships there are?
I guess to start very basically, you know, there's 4 years of OBGYN residency that all OBGYNs do. And then afterwards, there's the option to do a fellowship. There are certain fellowships that are like ACGME approved fellowships. So for instance, high risk obstetrics, that's called an MFM fellowship. Infertility called REI, reproductive endocrinology and infertility. And then Urogyn and MIGS, minimally invasive GYN surgery, is the other one, you know, that some of your listeners may have heard of, and that there are MIGS fellowships through AGL and through SLS. And essentially it's, you know, typically two years of additional training. And with MIGS, it's usually pretty broad. It's all of the more complex parts of GYN surgery, fibroids, endometriosis. Mm. And it's interesting because MIGS, it's really, you know, minimally invasive GYN surgery is talking more about, in a way, the approach, laparoscopic and robotic, versus, you know, with high risk OB or with infertility, it's more the subject matter. But I would say overall with MIGS, it tends to be, again, endometriosis, fibroids, all of the things that make GYN surgeries more complex. And so, you know, MIGS is not a fellowship through, gosh, I'm going to mix up my acronyms, through ABUG that like MFM and REI are, though I'm guessing in the next, you know, few years, it may be going that route as well. And a lot of the people who are, you know, experts in their fields now did more informal fellowships in the past. Like, for instance, Dr. Mossbrucker, who I'm working with now, did a fellowship with Dr. Redwine. You know, in the past, people really did fellowships more informally, and now they're getting more formalized. So what I'm doing is 2 years working with Dr. Mossbrucker, both in the clinic and the OR, and essentially, you know, learning from her expertise and her skill set. So it's a little different than people who are doing a fellowship like MIGS, where it may be kind of a broader scope in terms of laparoscopy and robotic surgery, fibroids, endometriosis. This with Dr. Mossbrucker is really focused specifically on endometriosis. Mm-hmm. So I think the word fellow, depending on, you know, a person's specific background, they may have done a fellowship with a specific physician, right, or, you know, nowadays fellowship could mean, again, doing a AAGL MIGS fellowship where you're at typically at an academic center. And again, I think it really varies. Some MIGS fellowships having more emphasis on endometriosis and others having less emphasis on endometriosis, just depending on who the faculty are. Mm-hmm. And I think in general, you know, for patients, someone who is MIGS trained means they're generally focusing on the GYN portion only and not the obstetric side. So someone who's MIGS trained is going to be better at approaching endometriosis surgeries, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they, for instance, are an excision expert.
I think it's important to note too that just because they've done a MIGS program doesn't make them a specialist in endometriosis.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the word specialist, it's so hard, like what defines a specialist? Yeah. That is hard. You know, certainly Dr. Mossbrucker is an endometriosis specialist. I think, again, people who have done a MIGS fellowship certainly have a lot more endometriosis training than someone who did general OBGYN residency, but I think there's just a lot of variation, you know, from program to program. And in a way, you know, I think about my fellowship with Dr. Mossbrucker, it's almost like an apprenticeship. You're learning, in this case, from a specific physician. And in this case, it is very, I would say, disease-focused with endometriosis. And in other programs, again, with MIGS, if you think about even the title, minimally invasive GYN surgery, the focus is on laparoscopic and robotic approaches, again, generally to complex GYN problems.
Yeah. What was, I mean, I know that you wanted to do the surgical side of things more, but what was it that pulled you more into the endometriosis side of doing a fellowship?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was thinking about this morning, like in a way it was really the surgery part, you know, that I was looking for and that I knew was, you know, an area that I felt like I wanted more, you know, to advance or to refine, but it was really kind of everything else that drew me in the sense of, you know, even going back to what I said early on, you know, being on my surgery rotations and like plastic surgery and ENT and feeling like I loved the, you know, the anatomy part of it, right, but felt like it wasn't my people, I feel like in this endometriosis world, like they're really, you have to kind of consider the whole body and be a little more holistic about the approach. And I think that's always, you know, been an interest of mine. And there is also this continuity with patients too, like through their journey. And so for me, it really is this just unique meld of kind of everything that I feel like I've been interested in and been good at, kind of coming together in one disease. And it's funny because I always, you know, thought of myself initially, you know, having this kind of broad approach. I would have never thought that I would, at the end of the day, want to have, you know, focus on just one one disease. But I feel like with endometriosis, you're bringing so many different things together. And also, again, it's like, if you think of 1 in 10 women having endometriosis, that is a large, you know, subset of women. And so we do need more people who are focusing on this. But yeah, I think it's just been really interesting how I wasn't, it's almost like I wasn't seeking endometriosis out, but it kind of found me in a way. Yeah,
I feel like that's true with a lot of doctors who have done that and they've, you know, talked about it. It's just the intrigue of it and the whole body approach to it and really seeing how unjustly it was treated within the healthcare system. And I think that's been probably one of the most shocking things for a lot of doctors who get into it is just, you know, not only from the excision standpoint, but as being recognized as something that is more harmful than just a painful period and seeing the effects that it has on the patients. And how it's treated when it comes to medical billing and how it's treated when it comes to people calling you crazy because of the pain, you know, and not recognizing that it's such a big pain contributor to different parts of your body beyond just your uterus or ovaries. And I think the fact that you've done this and you've seen two different sides of the coin, so to speak. You've seen it with the more marginalized community as an OBGYN, and now you're seeing it as a fellow in endometriosis. Just the healthcare discrepancies in women's health is a large discrepancy. I don't know how else to say that.
I mean, I think that's the other part, you know, in a way that has been hard. Like you know, as I was saying, as far back as residency, was really interested in working in an underserved area. The first, almost 10 years of my life, I worked at a Navajo reservation hospital. And so really was taking care of patients. I mean, again, not all, but for the most part, with much fewer resources. And now I'm sort of at the other end of the spectrum, working in a practice that is out of network with insurance and just very different patient population. And in some ways that has been hard. I come back to the fact that for these 2 years, I really am learning how to do these surgeries well and how to take care of patients with endometriosis well. And then I think, you know, the next battle that I feel like I want to put my energy into is, how do we make this more accessible for the average patient and make it so that, you know, right now I feel like a lot of the patients that I'm seeing have in a way found us, like they have come from sites like Nancy's Nook or their physical therapist suggested that they may have endo and come to us. But I think back to, you know, the patients that I was taking care of in my prior practice setting and, you know, they were really relying on what the GYN was telling them in the office. And it's like, how do we get to that point that patients are getting the info and the diagnosis from the person they're seeing, you know, for their appointment and don't need to come to it from this, you know, roundabout way. I mean, I think it's amazing all the advocacy that patients are doing for other patients and trying to get the word out. But in the long run, I just feel like there are so many battles still to be fought, you know, or how can we get to the place where insurance reimburses these procedures appropriately and sees, you know, not only that they're effective for the patient, but I can't imagine that it's not cost effective to do the, you know, surgery the right way the first time, as opposed to having, what do they say, the average patient, it's 7 years or 8 years until they get the diagnosis. And if you think that during that time, you know, the average patient has seen so many different providers, perhaps like had one or two surgeries, you know, it just seems to me like it has to be cost effective to do the right mm-hmm. thing first? And, you know, how do we get to that place with the insurance companies? And
yeah, I mean,
for now I'm going to focus on the surgeries, but yeah, all of those other battles, I feel like, are the other driver.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that going into the fellowship of just how?
I have to say, I was like when I was at the AAGL conference, I remember my residency colleague telling me that, yeah, the majority of excision surgeons being out of network. And I think, you know, coming from a very low resource place, I have to admit my first like reaction to that was like, well, that's not, that's not right. Or, you know, how can that be? I think I had a very limited understanding of, you know, why it is that they're out of network. And now I understand that much better and realize how complicated the issue is, you know, in mm-hmm. terms of, you know, if an insurance company reimburses the same way for a ablation as for a long complex surgery, you know, obviously that is part of the issue. And I would say more peripherally aware of right. the issue. And I think I had my biases about sort of being out of network now understand that better. And of course, hope that we get to a place where this is something that every patient has access to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you have a heart for the communities that are underserved and you want to be able to help those patients who can't pay out of pocket, you know, I think that's always got to be kind of on your mind. I know for me as a patient, it's always on my mind. Well, is insurance going to cover this? Am I going to be able to see the person that I want to, or that I need to see? It's not even I want to see. It's that I kind of need to see to get the proper care, right? That's a mm-hmm. challenge. And that's what I think sometimes can add to the trauma of the medical trauma, right? So it's not always necessarily that it's the doctors that are doing these things and the patients have bad outcomes. It's really that the medical system isn't set up for the patient to have long-term quality of life. And that's a little frustrating from the patient standpoint and the doctor standpoint. It's a complex thing that we don't have enough time to talk about, right?
I think it is going to have to come from, you know, both ends, like in terms of patient advocacy and then physicians to change the current system.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure
that there's more education during residency, making sure that, you know, even some of the ongoing like maintenance of certification involves more education mm-hmm. about endometriosis. And then, yeah, unfortunately, I don't think without addressing the reimbursement side of it, the issue will get solved.
Yeah. Was it, I think this is an interesting thing to think about. Were you aware of the 1 in 10 number prior to doing your fellowship?
No. No.
Interesting.
I knew it was relatively common, but I feel like that's a statistic that I more recently learned.
Was that a shock to you or was it, oh, that aligns, that checks out?
Of course, now I, you know, since I'm primarily seeing right. patients with endometriosis, it seems like it should be even, even higher, but I think it does make sense.
Yeah, I think that's something that we as people who have been in the endometriosis community oftentimes forget is just how many doctors don't have the knowledge of endometriosis because it's not the first thing that would pop into someone's head if they're not infiltrated with it, right? You, like you said, irritable bowel syndrome and other things that could contribute to pain factors, urination issues, whatever. So to think 1 in 10, you're not thinking, oh, that's this patient, you know, they just don't know. And that's unfortunate and something that I hope that we can get better at.
Bit of a system or an issue with our medical system as a whole, right? That you kind of get referred from specialist to one specialist to see another specialist and mm-hmm. they, you know, refer on. And it's like, who is the person putting it all together? So I think, yeah, even separate from GYNs needing more knowledge about endometriosis, it's probably also family practice doctors and internists. Mm-hmm. And
it's so nuanced, isn't it? Like this disease is just a very tricky disease. And I think something I admire about what you're doing is that you took yourself out of I don't know if it was comfort zone of knowing what you knew to get better. I think that's promising for a lot of us who have dealt with this disease for a long time is to be able to see someone say, I want to get better at my skill and my craft, and then I'm going to step out of that comfort zone. Do you think more and more doctors are going to start doing that to understand their patients better? Or is that something that's not really that common?
That's a good question. I mean, I think in some ways it's both, yeah, certainly stepping out of comfort zone in the sense that, you know, I was the department supervisor and now I'm kind of, you know, going back to a learning role and being at the bottom of the totem pole, to speak. But I think in other ways, it was also that I recognized there were, you know, certainly for large majority of GYN surgeries felt very comfortable, but also just like feeling that there were these more complex cases that I wanted to be able to do and not need to, you know, rely on referring to someone else. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it was almost like my discomfort with that drove me, you know, to wanting to learn more. Yeah, I think it's complicated. I think it's also complicated by the fact that, you know, OB and GYN are tied together as, you know, one specialty. And I think for a lot of general OBGYNs, the bulk of their practice is the OB side. You know, I think, again, obstetrics is such a bulk of our residency training. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, just the logistics of, you know, the average OBGYN's practice, I think, is heavily OB. Mm-hmm. And so I think everyone ideally would like to, you know, further their surgical skill set, but it is hard to do it unless you and I mean, I, you know, consider myself lucky that I was able to, you know, to say, okay, I'm going to take a 2-year mm-hmm. pause or I'm going to go back to learning. You know, I think in many cases, it may not be an option for people. There's school loans to pay back, there's family responsibilities, or, you know, you're in a practice where that's mm-hmm. not an option. So I consider myself lucky to have this opportunity and a supportive partner who was like encouraging me to go back and learn more. So I think it's one of those things where probably a lot of physicians would like to do something similar, but there's also the reality of how do you make that happen when you're already mm-hmm. 10 years into practice.
What's something that you wish that they would put into medical school and residency programs that you think would help just the general GYN be able to identify endometriosis better and even refer out appropriately?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way, medical school is where, you know, where it all starts. Right. And I think if more people can become aware or can be taught that endometriosis isn't just, you know, pain during, you know, your periods, and people see it as more of a multi-system, you know, there may be bladder involvement, bowel right. involvement, almost, you know, IBS. If you're considering a diagnosis of IBS, you know, you should also be thinking about possible endometriosis. I think if that can be incorporated into medical training, that would probably be the most helpful. Because yeah, the reality is, I don't think we will be able to train every general OBGYN to do these complex cases. And I think it is a matter of, you know, recognizing which cases mm-hmm. need to be referred out. But having it on your differential when it should be is probably a better goal. And then the other, I guess, big question is, how do we increase the number of people who are doing this type of surgery? Yeah. Because I think if, you know, once there is more awareness, there's going to be more of a demand for excision surgery. And then, you know, it's not like you'll be able to create the excision surgeons overnight, you know, preparing for that as well. I think it's a two-pronged approach, like creating awareness, but then also having, because that's going to create more demand for these types of surgeries. And then also having more GYN physicians who are able to do them.
Yeah. Oh, you give us hope, though. That's what I'm saying, right? You give us hope. Looking at your future, what are you excited for in where you're going with your fellowship and potential practice later down the line? What is exciting for you moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, right now, one of the things that is really the most exciting is sort of seeing, you know, the whole process through getting to see a patient in clinic and doing an initial consult, being there for the surgery, mm-hmm. Seeing them through the recovery period as well.
Yeah.
I think right now that's one of the things, you know, that is really and it's really part of how I'm learning too, right? Thinking back to what were the symptoms they, you know, talked about during the consult, mm-hmm. and then seeing, you know, the anatomy at the time of surgery, I think is one of the best ways to learn, is to have that continuity.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly where I will be when this fellowship concludes, and, you know, still thinking about bigger picture questions of like, whether I'll be able to make this entirely my focus or whether I will be, a GYN physician that is much better versed in endometriosis and, doing some of the perhaps simpler endometriosis cases and still seeing some other GYN types of problems, or being able to be like Dr. Massbrucker, who is really an excision expert. All of that, I think, still remains to be seen, but I'm just excited to learn more. And then, hopefully at some point in the future, be able to collaborate with other people who are focusing on this as well to address some of these bigger picture issues. Like, I'm looking forward to the conference in April that I'll be going to in Geneva, focusing on endometriosis and just getting to talk with other people who have made this their life's focus.
Yeah.
It's always exciting and inspiring. And
Oh, it's a breath of fresh air to hear you talk about it and just your journey. And like I said, I just really feel like you are on this journey with a lot of us. It feels like you're right there with us from the other perspective. And I think that's impactful for a lot of people to understand, because we can often feel like the doctors don't get it. They don't understand, but they do. It's just from a different standpoint, right? It's from a different perspective. And so to see it from this perspective and to see someone that has practiced for quite some time to be able to step back and learn some more and grow some more in their skill set is just refreshing for a lot of people. It is for me, at least. And I knew that when Nancy Peterson said, "You've got to meet this gal," I said, "Okay, Nancy, I'll meet her." And she said, "No, I want you to talk to her." I said, "Okay, Nancy, what you want, you get." So you made an impact.
Appreciate it. I had a chance to, when I first heard about the podcast, I got to listen to your story as one of the early episodes. And I felt like you were so thoughtful when you were talking about, the physician you had initially seen. Mm-hmm. When you talk, I felt like you even sort of beat yourself up about not having done, the research yourself about endometriosis, in the sense of kind of those early decisions. And I just appreciated your thoughtful approach to that. Because in many ways, I was identifying with that GYN that you initially saw, in terms of the steps.
Yeah.
And then through. So I appreciate all that you're doing to bring more information to other patients on their journey. And I appreciate you tying me in, because I'm on a similar journey myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of fun to see that journey happen. I'm excited to see what the future brings for you. I'm excited to see the change that you will elicit, because I really truly feel like having a broad picture of this is going to be impactful long term for many, many people. So I'm excited. Plus, you really have just a sweet heart for those patients and the underserved communities and the ones that are often overlooked. So thank you. Thank you for doing the work that you're doing.
Chat again when I'm closer to the end of my fellowship, but I've learned a few more things along the way.
Oh, I'd love that. That'd be so good. And then hopefully we'll get to meet in person one of these days and have those conversations.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your story and your heart. And I'm sure that people will be able to resonate with this. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Alana.
Oh my gosh. You're so welcome. And until next time, everyone, continue advocating for you and for those that you love.